This podcast includes descriptions of violence and death. Please take care while listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, please give your attention to the opening statement of Mr. Casey Arbenz on behalf of the defendant, Matthew Joseph Collins. Mr. Arbenz.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, everybody.
It's about 6 weeks into the trial of the three officers charged with the murder and manslaughter of Manny Ellis. The state called 20 witnesses and just rested its case. So now it's the defense's turn.
I was taught not to speak ill of the dead, and I have no intention to badmouth somebody who's no longer with us. We talked about in jury selection how horrible it is to have a loved one, a family member, who's got a problem with drug addiction.
The other defense teams gave their opening statements at the start of the trial, but Arbenz decided to wait. He got to hear all the state's evidence and see how the jury responded to it.
But this is a murder case, and one of the places we have to start in evaluating this case is with Mr. Ellis.
He starts his defense by talking to the jury about Manny.
Oftentimes in a case like this, you don't really know. You don't know how drugs might affect somebody. In this case, we do. And so we're going to start with Mr. Ellis. We know that he started using drugs when he was around 20, so he had about 13 years of meth addiction. And we know that in 2015, he had a violent encounter with police. And the defense is going to raise that, again, not to disparage Mr. Ellis, but to see what police officers who dealt with Mr. Ellis when he was under the influence of methamphetamine had to deal with.
From KNKX Public Radio and the Seattle Times, this is The Walk Home. I'm KNKX reporter Jared Brown. Today is December 14th. The jury is deliberating. This is the second and final part of our episode looking back at key moments in the trial. On part one, we walk through the two different stories by eyewitnesses and from the officers themselves that the jury was told about what happened the night Manny Ellis died. On this episode, we dive into the defense strategy, the dueling narratives over Manny's cause of death, and central questions that the jury is presented with. The attorneys for officers Matthew Collins, Christopher Burbank, and Timothy Rankin, they start their case here, almost 5 years before Manny and the officers ever meet, because what happened in March 2020, they say it's part of a pattern. So Casey Arbenz, the defense lawyer for Collins, he takes the jury back to September 21st, 2015. On this day, Manny has an argument with an ex-girlfriend at her house. He bites her, hard enough to leave bruising and teeth impressions. She bites him back. He leaves, and she calls 911. Pierce County Sheriff's Deputy Kevin Pressel responds when Manny is spotted in the area later that day.
We were able to locate him, advise him who we were, that he was under arrest.
At first, Manny cooperates and gets in the back of the patrol car, but he complains about the cuffs hurting his shoulder, so the deputy put another set on Manny to extend them.
He used the leverage that provided to start digging into his pocket. When I looked, because it was very odd behavior for someone to start reaching into their pockets after that, and so I looked and I could see the top end of a hypodermic needle that was hidden behind his cell phone.
Pressel suspects Manny is high on meth. He tells Manny to get out of the car, and when he doesn't, he pulls Manny out of the car.
He immediately started kicking and flailing and just resisting.
Pressel and two other deputies get on top of Manny. One deputy sat over his hips to keep him from bucking.
Back then, I was about 215 pounds, give or take, and he was lifting us off the ground.
The deputies get Manny back into one set of handcuffs and hog tie him on the ground. They call paramedics to get Manny checked out before booking him into jail. In court, Manny takes a plea for obstructing police and gets no jail time, as long as he can stay sober, report to his probation officer, and stay out of trouble. And he stays sober for a while, but it doesn't last. Arbenz brings up another incident where Manny had a violent interaction with the police. When Manny's life hit a turning point at pretty much rock bottom. A former girlfriend moved away with her daughter, a little girl Manny had adopted as his own. His mental health plunges, he owes thousands of dollars in court fees, and he relapses. He goes on a 5-day binge. On September 21st, 2019, Manny goes to a combination KFC and A&W, and he tries to climb over the counter. He gets beat up by the restaurant staff and runs away. Sheriff's deputies find Manny outside, running in traffic. He's naked and blood is streaming from his head. The deputies pull out their guns and tell him to get on the ground. Deputy Aaron Wolf was there. He says at first Manny complies, but then
the suspect jumped up and sprinted directly at us. And so I pointed my gun in, and I started to gain a proper posture to shoot center mass.
Before Deputy Wolf can shoot, another deputy fires a taser at Manny, and he falls to the ground at their feet. Wolf says they try to arrest him, but he says Manny's strong.
Deputy Bull had to use the taser again through the prongs that were already set in position from the first shot. At that point, he was able to be manipulated into a handcuffing position, and Deputy Lampton put on the handcuffs.
And then it was the same thing, the struggle, trying to get him in handcuffs, trying to get him restrained. They tried to call for aid. He was resistant to aid. He said, leave me the fuck alone. Nobody touch me. He didn't want anybody to even help him. So we know how drugs affect Mr. Ellis based on those two incidents.
The officers on trial want to show that their story about Manny attacking them at a stoplight late at night, that it makes sense because of how he'd acted around police before, particularly when he was high and court-ordered from using drugs. Records show Manny had more than 40 documented contacts with police throughout his life for a variety of reasons, and most never led to an arrest, or they involved charges that were ultimately dismissed. But these two incidents, where Manny was believed to have been high, combative, and to have struggled with officers, two times in his past where he had to be tased or hogtied, the judge ruled those incidents could shed some light on what happened the night Manny died. To allow those arrests into the trial is pretty unusual. Usually, the thinking is that if the defendant didn't know about something that happened in the past, then it's probably not relevant to the case. And the officers have clearly stated they did not know Manny or have any knowledge of his past when they encountered him on the night of March 3rd, 2020. But the officers' attorneys, they want to use Manny's prior arrests as evidence to suggest that because Manny behaved that way in 2015 and in 2019, it follows that he would behave that same way in 2020 when he encountered officers Collins and Burbank. That just like before, these officers encountered someone who was high and combative and out of control. The officers' attorneys even had their experts review these arrests to give medical opinions about Manny's behavior. And the judge, he agrees. He decides Manny's past is relevant because it might help explain how Manny's struggle with the officer started. What would cause him to act the way he did? Why he'd see police officers and attack them. The judge in this case is Brian Chushkoff. He's 72, and he's been on the Pierce County Superior Court bench since 1997, 26 years. He's the court's longest-serving judge.
What I do, if you haven't caught on by now, is there's a kind of devil's advocate thing here. I mean, I try to say, well, here's the argument that's being made. Show me where it's wrong. And when you do, then you win, right? But if you don't, then you've got a problem.
He tells lots of long stories about his time as a judge and a lawyer. Sometimes they turn out to be metaphors that explain why he made a ruling. Other times, they're less clear.
That's my style. Sometimes lawyers don't like it because they sometimes think I'm being aggressive towards them personally, and I'm not. I'm trying to get at the ideas or the principles in which they're trying to advance.
What is clear, though, from those drawn-out explanations, is some of his rulings have helped the officers during the trial. For starters, the jury doesn't know that the Pierce County investigation into Manny's death was so flawed the state decided to step in and take over. Judge Chushkoff also ruled the jury isn't allowed to know about any of the prior misconduct allegations against the charged officers. The jury doesn't know that Officer Burbank was involved in more than 15 use of force investigations and a racial profiling allegation when he worked as an officer in North Carolina before coming to Tacoma. When Officer Rankin was at the police academy, he completed a virtual training exercise where he was confronted with a virtual suspect. Rankin was supposed to use non-lethal force to restrain him, but instead, he shot him. His instructor wrote in a memo that Rankin experienced a, quote, mental break and wouldn't listen to corrective advice. Rankin ultimately passed the academy, but the instructor warned the Tacoma Police Department about the incident. The department hired him anyway. Rankin is also facing a lawsuit alleging he used excessive force on a man who said he couldn't breathe when Rankin was on his back. The judge excluded all that information from the trial. Excluding these parts of the officer's past, it's normal. Defendants have a lot of protections to make sure they get a fair trial and don't have a jury that's unfairly prejudiced against them. But the benefit of the doubt the officers get, their presumption of innocence, that stands in stark contrast to what the judge allowed to be shared about Manny's past, like that time in 2015 when Manny bit his girlfriend, and that time in 2019 when he was found naked in the street. More than almost anything else, the defense attorneys relied on Manny's past behavior to tell a story to the jury that says Manny had a motive to fight with the officers the night he died. He didn't want to go to jail, and that because of where he lived, because he used drugs, because of his history with police, Manny's death was a tragic outcome of his circumstances. And that had nothing to do with officers who were just doing their jobs. This also presents the jury with another central question. That night, was Manny an addict who had a habit of fighting officers when he was high, or someone who used drugs, but who was minding their own business, walking down the street with some late-night snacks? When Manny died, the Pierce County Medical Examiner ruled his death a homicide. Somebody else's actions killed him. The autopsy report said Manny had 2,400 nanograms per milliliter of methamphetamine in his system, a quote, extremely high concentration of meth, enough to kill him. The report also notes Manny had an enlarged heart. It says both of these factors contributed to his death, but ultimately, it's more likely than not that Manny died from hypoxia, or a lack of oxygen, due to physical restraint. Every medical expert who was called during the trial relied on this report to some extent to come to their own conclusions. The defense latched onto those contributing factors, the level of meth in Manny's system and his enlarged heart. They say that's what caused Manny's death, not the restraint. They say he behaved the same way he did in 2015 and 2019, but this time his body just gave out. The defense called one medical expert, an ER doctor named Jennifer Stankus. She works part-time at Madigan Army Medical Center, just south of Tacoma. She was a cop for a couple years and used to be a lawyer. She's local. She says she supports law enforcement, and she supports these officers.
So my opinion is that Mr. Ellis had a toxic and lethal amount of methamphetamine in his system, and that the effects of that with his underlying heart disease caused his death.
The state called four medical experts from across the country, people nationally recognized in their fields. All of them said it was everything together, the totality of the circumstances, all the force that the officers used that caused Manny to die from a lack of oxygen. The state called a cardiologist, someone who studies the heart, Dr. Dan Wohlgelernter. He says the rhythms of Manny's heart that were recorded by paramedics didn't look like someone who overdosed on meth.
The sequence of rhythm disorders, the atrial fibrillation, then asystole, and then continued atrial fibrillation with pulselessness are absolutely all consistent with hypoxia causing cardiac arrest. They are inconsistent with methamphetamine, inconsistent with underlying cardiac disease causing the cardiac arrest. So everything fits for this being restraint, asphyxia, causing hypoxia, causing cardiac arrest.
The state called a pulmonologist, someone who's an expert on lungs, Dr. Curtis Veal. He says the meth, the struggle, the taser shocks, and weight on Manny's back all increased the amount of oxygen Manny needed to live.
Having seen people with acute hypoxic respiratory failure, he was behaving as a person would be expected to do, especially with someone impairing their ability to expand their chest. So I believe the pressure on the back made it difficult to impossible for those changes that we outlined with the intercostal muscles and the ribs and all that to work.
The state also called a medical examiner from Washington, D.C., Dr. Roger Mitchell. He's a leading expert in in-custody deaths, and he reviewed Manny's autopsy. He says the way the officers restrained Manny prevented him from breathing.
After which someone has been in a violent altercation is going to impede his ability to then be able to get enough oxygen and to breathe as fully as he's needed in order to sustain his life. So he's walking home at that point. And the efficient intervening cause is the violent altercation in Subdul. It's him being beat up that's leading to his death.
Each of these experts spent time walking the jury through Manny's heart rhythms that were recorded by paramedics. The jury got a lesson in the anatomy of the heart and lungs. They looked at autopsy photos and talked about how methamphetamine affects the body and brain. They zoomed in on pictures of injuries to Manny's hands and face and where taser probes in his chest sent 50,000 volts of electricity through his body. The state noted how none of the officers had any serious injuries from the struggle, a few scrapes and bruises on their knees and knuckles. Their uniforms didn't tear or have any blood on them. The experts spent days on the stand, and at times their testimony is kind of hard to follow. But if there's such thing as a star witness in this case, it'd be
Dr. Thomas Clark, C-L-A-R-K.
Dr. Thomas Clark, the Pierce County medical examiner who did Manny's autopsy and determined it was a homicide. Clark was the fourth and final medical expert to take the stand for the state, and he defended his original findings. In his testimony, he says he's even more convinced in his conclusion today than he was when he did the autopsy 3 years ago. An attorney asks him why.
And so you said that you offered a supplemental report. After you talked to EMS, you read the additional materials, you learned about the weight on Mr. Ellis's back. Tell us how, if at all, did your conclusion in the first autopsy report that Mr. Ellis died from hypoxia due to physical restraint change, if at all?
It became stronger because I had more confidence in the fact that he didn't have a pulse, that he wasn't breathing, that he wasn't talking, and I had yet another force to put into the hypoxia group.
He says even though he noted in his report the level of methamphetamine in Manny's system was extremely high, that's not entirely conclusive because methamphetamine is unpredictable.
The amount that Mr. Ellis had is within the fatal range, but it isn't at the top of the fatal range, nor is it at the bottom. It's somewhere in the middle. It isn't possible to look at a number of a methamphetamine concentration and say it did or did not cause the death. It is also not possible to look at methamphetamine in general and say it always causes death when it gets to a certain amount or it never causes death below a specific amount.
Why is that?
Because it has unpredictable effects. We don't know exactly why it causes death under some circumstances and doesn't under others. But it's unpredictable to the point that an individual could take the same amount of methamphetamine every day for a month and then on day 31 take the same amount and die from it.
The other medical experts say the same thing. The central question posed to the jury here is, did Manny die from the officer's restraints, or did he die from his own meth use and enlarged heart? The next question is, did the officers use excessive force? Two experts offer their opinion on that after the break.
Hi, I'm Florna Halladavila with KNKX Public Radio.
I'm Jonathan Martin with the Seattle Times.
And Jonathan, our newsrooms got to collaborate together a couple years ago on a podcast called Outsiders.
It was such a great experience for us, and that's what brought us back here for another collaboration with KNKX.
I think it really serves audiences better when newsrooms work together.
These collaborations are interesting and fun, but they're complex, which is why we need your support to do more of them.
And the way to support future collaborations like this is to donate to KNKX by going to knkx.org.
And to donate to the Seattle Times Investigative Journalism Fund at st.news/IJF.
And thanks.
Each side called a use of force expert to talk specifically about the tactics the officers used and whether the force they used on Manny was reasonable. And these experts, they don't agree. They're kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum. the state called national use of force expert John Jack Ryan. Ryan was a police officer for 20 years in Rhode Island and has helped write policy in nearly two dozen states across the country. He says this was the first time he's ever testified against police officers. He says based on the evidence, he believes the officer's use of force wasn't justified.
One of the things we recognize is that when a person is struggling for breath, when their oxygen stopped, that they sometimes have involuntary movements that actually is not intentional resistance, but is actually fighting for breath. I don't see active resistance there. He's on his back with his feet in the air. So once the attack ends and you've got him on the ground, you can't keep hitting him.
He says officers all over the country have been trained for decades not to put weight on someone who is in a prone position the way they did to Manny. He says the health risks of the restraints they used were obvious.
The hog ties, when you put the ankles up like that, is highly discouraged in law enforcement because of the potential danger, particularly in prone restraint. So in my opinion, it was excessive at that point. He was handcuffed. He could have been put on his side. If he was kicking, you could have wrapped his ankles, but not cinched them up that way.
The officer's lawyers hired Chris Nielsen to defend them. He's been a police officer for nearly 13 years. He used to be a deputy prosecutor in King County, the neighboring county to where this trial is taking place. Now he works as a training sergeant for the Renton Police Department, another city in Washington. The defense emphasizes how he's local. He knows how policing is supposed to be done in Washington. He tells the jury about how use of force is evaluated.
For example, if someone slaps you, you might strike them or tase them or take them to the ground. But whatever the force, the resistance that you're getting, you have to come in a slight degree higher than that so that you're successful in detaining that person. Otherwise, you're just beating each other up, right? Or if you come in too low, then the officer would lose and suffer much more serious outcomes.
He says he saw Manny struggling and that the officer's use of force was entirely justifiable and appropriate for the level of resistance they faced. He thinks there's more that happened than what is captured on video, and that the officers faced an ongoing threat. Nielsen says in the evidence he saw, the officers tried several force options that failed, like a taser, and the officers needed to use more and more force to get Manny to comply, and that ultimately, applying pressure to Manny while he was on the ground was a relatively low level of force.
Mr. Ellis was clearly detained. He was clearly exhibiting behaviors to try to thwart further detention, right? And the risk was unknown, so you weigh that against the level of force, which is simply rolling him on his stomach and putting pressure on him until he stopped moving that way. I mean, that, to me, is a perfectly reasonable response to that conduct. Placing someone in the prone position and putting transient weight on their back is a very low likelihood of a bad outcome. They do happen, but it's a very low likelihood of a bad outcome.
There could have been more testimony from other police experts. Specifically, the prosecution wanted to call officials from the State Police Academy to speak to the specific training that these three officers got. But the judge in the case, he wanted to move the trial along, and he didn't see a big enough controversy around the training to make it relevant at the time. And the state didn't try to call them again. The judge also blocked a witness who planned to speak about Officer Burbank's training at his old department in North Carolina, and former Tacoma Police Chief Don Ramsdell, who would have testified to the policies and training in Tacoma. The picture that the defense painted of Manny, Collins' statement that Manny told him he was having a bad night, it's very different than what Manny's family and the people who were with him that night had to say. Manny's landlord testified Manny was in good spirits that night. They had just come back from church.
Manny was really happy that we had went to the revival. He didn't seem, I'll say it like this, he didn't seem like he was off in any kind of way.
Manny's mother, Marcia Carter Patterson, spoke to Manny the night he died. She testified he had turned a corner in his life.
He looked good. He looked happy. That was the night that he said, "Mom, I really want to give my life to the Lord."
Marcia painted her nails a bright yellow color, the same color of the sweatpants that Manny wore the night he died. Throughout the trial, she wore bright yellow jackets and shirts every day. One shirt has a picture of her and Manny smiling together at a party. On the stand, she tells the jury Manny, her middle child, was a talented musician, a beloved brother and uncle.
Manny loved his family. He was very, very close to all of us. Manny was the glue of our family. He kept us all together.
Manny's little sister, Monet Carter Mixon, was the one who found the eyewitnesses and the videos that led to more scrutiny of the officer stories. If it weren't for her, there's no way to know whether anyone would have questioned the officer stories at all. She didn't shy away from the fact that Manny used drugs.
I wasn't concerned about his behavior when he was, if he was high or if he had a meth addiction, because of the way that he acted when he was around us. He didn't scare my children. He didn't scare me. He didn't act violent towards any of us ever. And he was actually a joy to be around.
Monet tells the jury Manny was more than the person they saw on videos in the courtroom. He was more than a body to be examined. He wasn't a violent drug addict who had a history of fighting with officers.
We talked, if not every day, like on the phone or FaceTime, at least we texted throughout the day. Even if we didn't always make a phone call, we talked constantly. He babysat my kids for me. At the time, I had 5 kids and I was a single mom, so he helped me a lot with my kids. He watched them if I needed childcare for one of them because they were sick and couldn't go to school. So he was my best friend. He was my person. When I needed him, he was always there for me.
As she spoke, a picture of Manny smiling was displayed on screens in the courtroom. It was allowed to stay up, despite objections from the defense. But soon, it would be replaced by close-up pictures of Manny's injuries, abrasions to his face, blood on his knuckles, marks on his ankles and wrists. It would show over and over videos of Manny being thrown to the ground, hit, and tasered. And it would play the sound of Manny crying out for help over and over again. If you've listened to all of this and you're still wondering what happened that night, so are we. After more than 2 months of trial testimony, we still don't know much more about what happened on the night of March 3rd, 2020 than we did 3 years ago. Nothing was really established as fact. So many key events are still in dispute. The officers said the things that sounded bad in those first interviews they gave. They misspoke. They didn't realize the gravity of the situation. We have a few more pieces of the puzzle, but the picture isn't much clearer. We thought that this case would turn on answering the question, how did Manny die? There were a dozen medical experts on the attorney's witness list, but the state only ended up calling 4, and the defense called 1. During the trial, the attorneys for the officers haven't been so much asking, how did Manny die, as they've been asking, how did Manny put himself in a position to die? That question became pretty clear early on in the trial, when the officers' attorneys were questioning one of the state's experts, Dr. Roger Mitchell. He's the former chief medical examiner for Washington, D.C., and now he teaches forensic pathology at Howard University. He's one of the leading experts on deaths in custody. Under cross-examination, Mitchell goes back and forth with one of Burbank's attorneys about his findings. The audio is a little hard to hear, but the attorney asks, Manny has external injuries, bruising and abrasions on his face. But none of those injuries are fatal, right?
Well, that's the point, is that he was in a fight and lost. And he lost with his life.
The attorney says, but Manny was ultimately arrested that night.
I understand that, but if we're talking about the fight, if I may, the fight is what killed him.
Well, the fight's not what killed him. He killed himself by resisting police officers.
The jury that's deciding this case includes 7 men and 5 women. 2 people appear to be black, 1 person self-identified as multiracial, and the other 9 jurors appear to be white. 3 people have military experience, 1 used to work as an animal control officer, and another used to work as a retail security guard. 1 person is retired, there's an executive, an accountant, a private school teacher, an electrician, and someone who works in the aerospace industry. 1 is a minister, and another is married to a pastor. 1 person is serving on a jury for the first time. This is the body that will have to weigh the evidence and determine who to believe. Who is credible? Nobody else can make that conclusion. not the attorneys or the experts, not the judge. It's something the state's use of force expert, Jack Ryan, touched on during his testimony.
Yes, so based on the version of events that the officers have stated, they certainly would have had reasonable suspicion to stop, and they would have had probable cause to arrest if Mr. Ellis, for lack of a better term, came at them in the car unprovoked, as they've reported, then they would have absolutely had sufficient information to stop and to arrest, in my opinion.
Did you also review the civilians' accounts from Ms. McDowell, Keon Lowry, and Mr. Seth Cowden?
I did.
And then video evidence from the Vivint camera, Mr. Cowden, and Ms. McDowell's phone?
Yes, I did.
And in reviewing the civilian statements, did you have a different opinion that you reached regarding that initial contact was lawful?
Yes. If you were to adopt their version of events, then there wouldn't be any reason to stop him. And again, being the version of events that he just simply was crossing the street, was maybe called back to the police car and then started walking away, and then suddenly there's this unprovoked going after him. So under that version of events, I would say there would be no reason to stop and no reason to arrest.
And is your role here as an expert witness to determine a credibility of the accounts?
No, it's not. That's up to you.
You, as in the jury, those 12 people, they decide. Was Manny an addict who has a history of being aggressive with officers while he's high, or just minding his own business on the way home from the store? Was Manny kicking and swinging wildly at the officers, or was he gasping for air, struggling to breathe? Which story will they believe? Officer Matthew Collins, a 40-year-old father of four, and Christopher Shane Burbank, a married 38-year-old, are both charged with second-degree murder, facing 10 to 18 years in prison. They're also charged with first-degree manslaughter, facing 6 to 8 years in prison. Officer Timothy Rankin, a newly married 35-year-old, is also charged with first-degree manslaughter, facing 6 to 8 years in prison. In order to come to a verdict, the jurors have to unanimously agree one way or the other, guilty or not guilty. If even one juror holds out, if just one person disagrees with the rest of the group, that can cause a hung jury. That means a mistrial. And that means prosecutors would have to decide whether it would be justified to try these officers again. And we go back to square one, back to where we were the morning after Manny Ellis died, at the intersection of 96th and Ainsworth. You can find all our reporting about the trial in this case at knkx.org/tpdtrial. This episode was reported by me, Jared Brown, KNKX Special Projects reporter Maiwa Aina, and Seattle Times senior investigative reporter Patrick Malone. It was written by me and Maiwa. Our executive producers are Florangela Davila and Jonathan Martin. They edited this episode with help from Amy Jeffries. Special thank you to Florangela for guiding this project over the last 3 years. We couldn't have done it without you. We had research help from Miyoko Wolf. Music comes from Marcel E.C. Augustin, Will Jordan, and Quincy Q. Henry.